This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Turkey agreed to a 120-hour ceasefire in its assault on Kurdish fighters in northern Syria. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence announced this in Ankara after extensive talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. VOA Cindy Sane reports.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo headed to Turkey Thursday to push Erdogan to stop the attacks. After hours of talks, Pence made this announcement.
And today, I'm proud to report, thanks to the strong leadership of President Donald Trump and the strong relationship between President Erdogan and Turkey and the United States of America, that today the United States and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria.
Pence said that Turkey has agreed to pause its assault for 5 days, while the U.S. facilitates the withdrawal of Kurdish fighters from a large swath of territory that stretched from Turkey's border nearly 32 kilometers into Syria. Cindy Sane, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump spent Thursday in Texas rallying to drum up support from his base in a state that until recently can be counted on to vote Republican but may be shaping up to become a battleground. Mr. Trump arrived in Texas as news broke about the ceasefire agreement reached by the United States and Turkey, with Ankara agreeing to suspend its military operation. Speaking in Fort Worth before participating in a roundtable with supporters and a fundraiser luncheon in Fort Worth, Mr. Trump called the ceasefire an incredible outcome and something they've been trying to get for 10 years. This is VOA News. Next year's Group of Seven Leaders Summit will be held at one of the U.S. president's properties in the state of Florida. In making the announcement Thursday, Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney defended the site selection process from immediate criticism that Mr. Trump will personally benefit from hosting the major event at one of his resorts. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler is calling the election of the Trump a personal property for the meeting as among the most brazen examples yet of the president's corruption, adding that he believes Mr. Trump is exploiting his office and making official U.S. government decisions for his personal financial gain. The White House admitted Thursday that U.S. President Trump froze $400 million in badly needed military aid to Ukraine to pressure it into investigating Democrats and the 2016 presidential election. Mick Mulvaney accused the media of misconstruing what he said to benefit the bias and political witch hunt. But Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, who's leading the impeachment inquiry into Mr. Trump, said he thinks that Mr. Mulvaney's acknowledgement means that things have gone from very, very bad to much, much worse. Mourning on Capitol Hill Thursday by members of both political parties after the announcement that U.S. Congressman Elijah Cummings of the U.S. state of Maryland has died. VOA's Catherine Gibson reporting from Washington.
Head of the House Oversight Committee leading the impeachment inquiry into Trump, Cummings had a fierce sense of justice that still drew respect from fellow Republicans. President Trump tweeted his condolences, but earlier this summer, he had harsh words for Cummings and his predominantly African-American home city of Baltimore.
Those people are living in hell in Baltimore.
The president's claim Cummings District was a rat and rodent infested mess seen as a racially insensitive attack, looked at as retaliation for Cummings' investigations into the administration.
We are the United States of America. We are the greatest country in the world. We are the ones that can go anywhere in the world and save people.
But both Democrats and Republicans remembered him Thursday as one of the leading figures in Congress for his strong values. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And you can find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mozambique's Electoral Commission is expected to announce preliminary results from Tuesday's general elections.
Today, most of the districts will be releasing the results at their level, which will be sent to the provincial commission so that they can be endorsed at the provincial commission's level. And by next week, they should get to the National Electoral Commission.
Gambia's former military junta vice chairman confesses to killing arming officers. Meanwhile, Gambian authorities arrest 10 trawlers for illegally fishing off the coast of the Gambia. Sudan's border closures with Libya and the Central African Republic are having an impact. And SPLM North rebels will return to peace talks with the Sudan government today, Friday.
We have seen the government of Khartoum made some steps which we regarded as positive towards addressing all those issues, but there are still some loopholes need to be done.
Amar Amoah is the SPLN North Secretary General and spokesperson, and Nigerian authorities want to alleviate extreme poverty. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mozambique's National Electoral Commission says preliminary results from Tuesday's general elections will be announced today, Friday. Commission spokesperson Paulo Quinica also says the commission is pleased with initial reports from both local and international poll observer groups, saying that the elections were organized in a credible and transparent manner. However, the European Union Observer Mission said on Thursday that the polls were marred by an unlevel playing field in favor of the ruling Frelimo party. Commission spokesperson Quinica says the elections were held in a peaceful atmosphere despite fears of violence.
They are released in three levels. The district levels, which happens within 72 hours after the closing of the polls. And therefore, that will only happen on Friday. And then 5 days later, it will be the provincial level. And finally, within 15 days, it will be the National Electoral Commission. So far, the districts are processing the results. And today, most of the districts will be releasing the results at their level, which will be sent to the provincial commission so that they can be endorsed at the provincial commission's level. And therefore, let us say by next week, they should get to the National Electoral Commission for final endorsement.
Paulo, we had reports that because of what some people have said to be a delay in releasing the result, there is rising tension because of delay. How do you respond to that?
No tension at all. Those are rumors which have no space, because the election has gone smoothly in spite of some problems here and there, because people do not want to allow the counting to start. But I'll assure you that the situation is calm all over the country now. The processing at the district level, as I've just said, is going on. And by Friday, sure, we will get the final results at the district level. All international missions have released their statements today, which are very good. They said that the election was very well organized. It was held in a very good atmosphere, except the closing in very particular areas which have been identified.
What do you say to critics who say the process of compiling the results or counting it has been too slow?
Isn't slow at all. The commissions are within the 72 hours after closing of the poll. The results will be released. So everything is according to the law.
Are you working with security agencies to prevent possible interference by people who are not supposed to be there, try to undermine the integrity of the election? Because there are reports that there could be possible post-election violence because there were reports of violence during the campaigns leading up to the elections.
Not at all. Things are going smoothly. The defense and security force have guaranteed that we managed to collect 99.9% of the counting material, except in one place where we lost 6 voting stations given to the riots of the people who have managed to burn out the material from the 6 polling stations. But in general, all the material were collected except those 6 places.
Paulo Quinica is the spokesperson for the Mozambican National Electoral Commission. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital Maputo. A faction of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, SPLM North, based in the Numba Mountains, which on Wednesday announced it was suspending Juba-sponsored peace talks with Khartoum after government forces allegedly bombed villages in the Numba Mountains, now says it will return to the negotiating table because the government has addressed their concerns. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Amar Amoa, the Secretary General of the SPLM North, told the reporters in Juba the transitional Khartoum government has taken what he calls positive steps to address the Amti group's concerns.
Since yesterday in the morning, we have been following the situation on the ground, and we have seen the government of Khartoum made some steps which we regarded as positive towards addressing all those issues, but there are still some loopholes need to be done.
Amoa says the government has met some of their demands, including the release of traders arrested by the government forces.
Those who have been arrested, they were released, but their goods and belongings and their motorbike are still with the government. We need the mediators to follow the government so as to release the properties of those people. We know some people have been killed, and those who are injured, they are still in the hospital. And the occupying forces have withdrawn, but there is still somewhere is still posing threats to the farmers.
He says his group will not allow government forces to violate the rights of the Nuba people.
Well, we need the government to respect the government of South Sudan, to respect the spirit with which the president offered to mediate, and they have accepted, and they should cooperate so as to create conducive environment for negotiations.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to the spokesperson of the Sudanese delegation at the talks, Mohamed Hassan Al-Taisi, but Al-Taisi said he could not comment because he was heading to a meeting. Toothkeo Galwak, South Sudan's chief mediator at the talks, confirmed the SPLM North agreed to resume talks with the government on Friday.
The group of Commander Al-Hilu has returned for the talks, and so tomorrow at 9 a.m. we are going to start the talks between the government of Sudan and the group of SPLM North led by Al-Hilu.
Meanwhile, the Sudan Revolutionary Front, or SRF, an umbrella group of at least 10 rebel groups, are demanding mediators adjourn the talks for at least 2 weeks so that some of their field commanders have time to travel to Juba to participate in the talks. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Sudan recently ordered the closure of its borders with the Central African Republic and Libya over security concerns, the first major policy decision by the ruling Sovereign Council since the fall of former President Omar al-Bashir. But while some have welcomed the measure, border traders say the closures threaten their livelihood. Naba Muhyiddin has the reaction from Khartoum.
3 weeks ago, Sudan's executive body ordered the closure of the country's borders with the Central African Republic and Libya, citing security concerns. The order has been gradually implemented since. However, some Sudanese say the decision is affecting business. The country is enduring a transportation crisis brought on by a shortage of fuel and spare parts for vehicles. Spare parts trader Ahmed Bouchara thinks opening the borders would ease the situation. Bouchara says the current high price of transportation isn't about the fuel shortages only. Spare parts are a major element for the cars. If the borders are open and trade is facilitated, it will reflect positively on the car sector and spare parts. There is no need for such a decision, he says. It's better to monitor movement on the borders and allow youngsters to cross only if they want to trade. Unlike Bouchara, Numan Issa has welcomed the measure, even though he once tried to migrate through Libya to Europe, only to return to Darfur. Numan says Libyan gangs and militias are a danger for Sudanese youth, hoping to escape poverty and strife. Issa says he is one of the people who lost their friends and colleagues in Libya. He said the measure is positive if it will stop the illegal migration, but he hopes the new government will deal with the people detained and lost in Libya, and also handle the root cause of Sudanese youngsters leaving and put in measures for legal migration. The Sovereign Council decided to close the borders after a September clash between rival militias in Birao, Central African Republic, that left 23 people dead. Council members cited reports that militiamen were sneaking into Sudan on their way to join other militias in Libya. But political analyst Othman Merghani thinks the council has both economic and security concerns.
Putting in consideration that the main smuggling of commodities is one of the eastern borders, not on the western ones, he says, western borders have many security concerns, especially weapon smuggling and armed troops entering the country from Libya and other countries that suffer from security issues. Sudan is located on a widely used migration route that links East and Central Africa with the Mediterranean and Europe. The unrest Sudan has been before and since the ouster of Bashir led the European Union to suspend funds for migration control, allowing a greater number of migrants to enter the country. It remains to be seen whether the border closures will slow down the flow. Neba Muhiddin for VUA News, Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, October 18th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Gambia's former military junta, vice chairman and defense minister has confessed to killing army officers accused of a coup plot in November 1994. Retired army captain Edward Singate made the confession on Thursday before the country's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission. Singate told the commission that he and his colleagues were given orders by then junta leader Yahya Jammeh to quell the alleged coup plot without taking any prisoners. Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Thursday was his second day to appear before the TRRC. The former junta number two man, Edward David Singate, has finally admitted to taking part in the execution of some army officers who were accused of coup plot back in November of 1994.
Madam Chairperson, if I may, for the record, I participated. I am not reneging on my responsibility for the execution of the order, and I take full responsibility for my actions. I want you to know that I was there, and I'm deeply remorseful for it.
Former Army Lieutenant Bashir Barrow and Lieutenant Ablai Dotfal were among the first captured officers to be killed. The remaining detained officers and soldiers were subsequently executed. In total, about a dozen officers were executed. Edward Singate again.
Even if you take me to court or prosecute me for it, I will agree that yes, I was there and I participated. It was wrong and illegal.
Singate says upon the execution of Barrow and Fall, they were ordered by Jammeh to kill the remaining detainees. He says Jammeh's reason was that if the detainees were to be spared, other soldiers could have organized a counter coup to rescue the detainees.
He said that, do you not know that if they had succeeded, we would all be dead? So why did you leave them? You should not have spared them. He also said that if they are kept alive, they have sympathizers within the ranks that could move to free them, and they would execute their intentions against us by launching an attack and killing us and our families as they had initially planned. So he told us to go back and finish the job.
Esa Fall is the lead counsel at Gambia's TRRC. Fall asked Singate if he would concede to murder charges.
Mr. Singate, would you plead guilty to a charge of murder?
Sir, if it came down to that, I would.
So you say you are guilty of those two murders?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Singate has appealed to his victims and families to forgive him.
I would like to take this opportunity to apologize. I am deeply sorry for my actions. Like I said with the previous apology, I can only imagine the pain that they would have gone through, not knowing what happened to their father, their husband, their son, their brother. I can only pray that the Almighty Allah will instill forgiveness in their hearts towards us.
Singate has also been accused of taking part in the murder of Gambia's former finance minister, Ousmane Kourou-Cissé. He is yet to be questioned on Koro's alleged murder case. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Gambian law enforcement agents with the Department of Fisheries and the Gambian Navy worked with the marine conservation organization Sea Shepherd to covertly apprehend and arrest 10 trawlers fishing illegally off the coast of the Gambia. Mavis Ocherit with the VOA spoke with Peter Hammerstedt, the director for campaign for the marine conservation organization Sea Shepherd.
The Gambia is a coastal state off Africa that has a robust navy but doesn't have a vessel that allows them to cover the entirety of their waters. And therefore, the government of the Gambia has partnered with Sea Shepherd in order for Sea Shepherd to provide this critical tool in their law enforcement arsenal, namely a civilian offshore patrol vessel that can cover the entirety of the Gambia's sovereign waters. The Sea Shepherd vessel Sam Simon operates as a vessel entirely under the direction of the Gambian government, and on board the ship are sailors from the Gambian Navy and fisheries inspectors from the Ministry of Fisheries.
So can you name the fishing vessels that were arrested in the operation?
A number of vessels were arrested. Nine of those vessels were arrested for fishing inside a specially designated area that's reserved for artisanal fishermen. About 200,000 Gambians, 10% of the population of the country, depend on the local fisheries for their livelihood. And therefore, the Gambian government has widely restricted a certain area just reserved for the local fishermen. But every single night, trawlers, these industrial boats, are known to come into that 9 nautical mile area and to fish without permission.
What happens to the trawlers who have been arrested?
The vessels enter the legal system of the Gambia, so usually these vessels have some kind of legal repercussion. Usually they have to pay a fine, and the purpose of that fine is to serve as a deterrent for breaking the law in the future. And also these fines generate critical revenue for the country as well.
Are there any measures to prevent such occurrences in the future?
Well, Sea Shepherd is committed to a long-term partnership with the Gambia, and it's our intention to continue doing joint patrols offshore. But also with the arrest of these vessels and the legal proceeding follow, we hope that the arrest and the subsequent fines that are levied onto these ships for breaking the law will also serve as a deterrent to prevent future crime.
Peter Hamistead is the director for campaign for the marine conservation organization Sea Shepherd. He spoke with reporter Mavis Ocheri. In Nigeria, an estimated 94 million people, or nearly half the total population, live in extreme poverty. This year's figure is 6.8 million higher than in 2018. Nigerian authorities have been trying to improve the situation. But as Timothy Obiezu reports, experts argue the government plans are not sustainable and not capable of fixing the problem.
Uzuamaka Ndugo struggles daily to raise 5 children after separating from her husband in Abuja 6 years ago. To make ends meet, she ventured into selling plastic bottles. But Ndugo says her income averages about $30 per month, hardly enough to provide for her family or stay in business.
Since 2013, Muradim Soroku. So half from Maka.
Since my husband left me with the children, I've been the one taking care of them from the sales of my plastic bottles. I have no other job. Before I pay their school fees, it is not easy for me, she says. Some 93.7 million Nigerians live in extreme poverty, according to the World Poverty Clock, a data-gathering team that monitors for global progress against poverty. In June last year, the group named Nigeria the world poverty capital after it overtook India, having the highest proportion of poor people. Economic experts like Nonso Obikili say an imbalance in economic and population growth is a major factor contributing to Nigeria's rise in poverty.
On a fundamental level, the economy is not growing fast enough. Economic growth is still below 2%, and population growth is about 2.7-2.8%. So that means on average, Nigerians are getting poorer and poorer.
Nigerian officials have been trying to address the issue through various social schemes. This month, President Muhammadu Buhari reiterated his commitment to lifting millions from poverty.
Our ongoing social intervention program continues to target these vulnerable groups through the homegrown school feeding program, government economic empowerment program, empower job creation program, loans for traders and artisans, conditional cash transfers to the poorest families.
However, Obikili says the government's plans are not enough, especially its cash transfer program to poor families.
If you're in an environment where economic growth is strong, then you can make the case for that. But if you're in an environment where there's no economic growth, then it's not clear how redistributive policies can reduce poverty sustainably.
President Buhari's lofty goal is to alleviate 100 million Nigerians from poverty within the next decade. But experts say to increase the poverty escape rate in the country, economic growth must remain steady and the population growth controlled. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson Omande in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Egypt, where one of Egypt's most successful football club side, Al Ahly, on Thursday refused to play in the Premier League before playing their postponed match against Zamalek was put off upon the request of the authorities, putting more pressure in the ongoing crisis. The Cairo Derby was scheduled for next Saturday, but a decision by the Egyptian Football Association late on Tuesday moved the game to a yet-to-be-determined date and venue. The EFA decision caused the outcry of several clubs and officials due to the disruption of the competition. In a statement issued on the official website on Thursday, the Cairo Giants stressed their respect of security instructions which delayed the game in the fourth round of the Egyptian Premier League. Elsewhere in Ghana, the Normalization Committee of the Ghana Football Association will, in partnership with three media organizations, organize a live radio and television debate for five of the six presidential candidates of the upcoming Ghana Football Association elections. The debate will be held on Monday, October the 21st, and will focus on key areas affecting the development of Ghana football, and questions will seek to elicit solutions-based responses from the presidential candidates. Five of the six presidential candidates have confirmed participation in the debate. They are Amanda Clinton, Fred Palpe, Kurt Okraku, Nana Yor Amponsa, and George Akoma Mensah. In athletics news, Joshua Cheptegei, the men's 10,000 meters gold medalist at the just-concluded IAAF World Athletics Championship in Doha, has been named among the nominees for the annual IAAF Male Athlete of the Year Award. Joshua Cheptegei became the first Ugandan in history to make the 11-man shortlist made by a panel of athletics experts with representation from IAAF's six continental areas. The 23-year-old overcame a life-threatening accident in December last year and recovered to win the men's 10 kilometers race at the IAAF World Cross Country Championships in Aarhus, Denmark on March 30th. He then stunned Ethiopians to bag the men's 5,000 meters trophy at the IAAF Diamond League final in Zurich, Switzerland on August 29th before conquering the 25-lap race at the Khalifa International Stadium with a world lead time of 26 minutes 48.36 seconds in Doha. In handball news, Kenya and Cameroon have withdrawn from the 2019 Women's Handball African Olympic Qualification Tournament in Dakar, Senegal next month. The withdrawal of Cameroon and Kenya leaves just Angola, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and host Senegal to battle it out for the lone spot at the Tokyo Olympic Games in 2020. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A faction of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, NOF, SPLM NOF, based in the Numba Mountains, which on Wednesday announced it was suspending the Juba-sponsored peace talks with Khartoum after government forces allegedly bombed villages in the Numba Mountains, now says it will return to the negotiating table because the government has addressed their concerns. Mozambique's National Electoral Commission says preliminary results from Tuesday's general elections will be announced today, Friday. Commission spokesperson Paulo Quinica also says the commission is pleased with initial reports from both local and international poll observer groups, saying that the elections were organized in a credible and transparent manner. That is it for this Friday, October 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson Omale, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. for your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.